Hi, you're back to Liquid Sound. I'm your host, Gintaris, here on Morton College Radio. Today we are having a conversation with Achio Bejas, an author, professor, and social activist. She's the author of three novels, Memory Mambo, Days of Awe, and Ruins, and also a variety of other things that I mentioned in the first half. Episodes of Liquid Sound have now been archived on my website, gint-aras.com. That's gint-aras.com. And if you go up to the Liquid Sound link up on the drop-down menu, you will access an archive of Liquid Sound recordings from the previous semester and the summer of 2012. Next week on Liquid Sound, I'll be interviewing a pair of former students who have recently graduated from teaching colleges, from colleges that prepare teachers, and are in the process of going through their student teaching at a pair of Chicago public schools. One is on the southwest side and one is on the west side, the Roberto Clemente High School and Curie High School on the southwest side. So tune in next week to listen to a pair of students tell their stories of their experiences of what it was like to graduate from Morton and then go on to a four-year school and eventually to get a professional degree. All right, now let's get back to the conversation with Achio Bejas. We, in the first half of the show, we discussed Cuba, specifically at this point, Fidel Castro's ability to give Cuba a good name and create what I called in the first half of the show a type of mythology or propaganda surrounding Cuba. Achio continues that conversation in the second half with an anecdote of what it was like for her to have a conversation with Russians in the United States about her Cuban identity and Cuba in general.
I've had two interesting and weird experiences with Russians around being Cuban. Mm. You know, kind of weird. You know, this friend of mine and I were in New York, and we went to get a massage at a spa. And the women who were doing the massage were Russians. Mm-hmm. They heard us speaking in Spanish, and they asked where we were from. And when we said Cuba, their entire energy shifted. Mm-hmm. I swear to God, they beat the fuck out of us. Because they were just, they actually, one of the women actually said to us, if we had not had to support your country, we would not have gone bankrupt, and my life would be totally different. I'd be home with my family instead of in New York doing this shit. And then in another case, it was here in Chicago, and a Cuban friend of mine and I, she needed to buy me to go with her to see this particular car. I was just the, you know, making sure she lived through this interaction kind of thing. And again, the fellow who was selling the car was Russian, and we're in the car where she's test driving it. I'm sitting in the back seat. We talk in Spanish. He said, where are you from? He said, are you Puerto Rican? And we said, no, we're Cuban. And he said, let's go back. And we were like, excuse me? And he said, I'm not selling you the car. Let's go back. Wow. And we were like, what are you talking about? And he said, I'm not selling you the car. You people ruined my life. Mm-hmm. You know, that stupid island, you know, bankrupted us. Mm-hmm. If we hadn't gotten bankrupt, I wouldn't have had to leave. And the same story. I mean, almost verbatim. We were like, okay, this is really weird.
Yeah, yeah.
But he refused to sell her the car because she was Cuban and she'd ruined his life. Mm-hmm.
Among Lithuanians, the story that you get most often about Cuba, or the story that I've gotten most often about Cuba, is that Cuban sugar was inferior to the sugar that was available from Russia that was made out of not beets, but out of turnips, right? But that's it. You don't get that one. You don't get,
Yeah,
this ruined
everything. Cuba doesn't grow beet sugar. It grows cane sugar.
No, cane sugar, that's what I'm talking about. But yeah. Their belief is that, or at least their perception is that cane sugar isn't as sweet as this turnip sugar. But that's it. That's the only story you get. You don't get anything else. You don't get...
You know, I'm sure that the sugar wasn't particularly good. I mean, the sugar harvests in the revolution have been historically low. Mm. You know, they were feeling really good last year because they got 2 tons, which was pretty par prior to the revolution. I mean, it's an antiquated and horrible system that they've got. Raul, to his credit, is trying to change things. He's
now, you've mentioned Raul twice. Is he really in charge?
Yeah, I think he really is in charge. I mean, I know that some people say he's not, but I mean, you see some things that are just so different. that have to do much more with his own thinking. I mean, the most basic difference I think between Raoul and Fidel is that Raoul doesn't feel the need to be a protagonist. And so because of that, he's now busy projecting to the whole world what a great guy he is. His ego, I'm not saying he doesn't have one or that he doesn't have a rather large and healthy one. Yeah. But it just, you know, not everything is dwarfed by Fidel's ego. And, I mean, you can see it in their ways of doing things. I mean, Raoul has given, like, what, 4 speeches? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Fidel gave one every week for many hours.
Yeah, he's not on TV every day.
Yeah, no, Raoul is not on TV every day. And when he talks very straightforward. He talks about concrete things. You know, 15, 20 minutes, it's over, and let's move on. He gives other people a chance to talk. And he's done some things that are good. I mean, you can say talk all day about what a horrible man he is, but he, you know, he has made the decision that his concern is Cuba, not how Cuba looks out in the world, and that the resources will be put into Cuba to save Cubans as opposed to, you know, spending $250 million in medical assistance to Pakistan after an earthquake, which Fidel did, and which people were furious about. You know,
which people?
Cubans.
Cubans
were furious about it because it was like, if we have $250 million, why do I have a blackout 8 hours a day?
Why don't I have toothpaste?
Yeah, that kind of thing. So it was just crazy. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, a lot of that is because Raoul's kids all live in Cuba. And unlike Fidel's kids, about half of them live in Cuba, and the other half live everywhere else. Fidel's kids are very sheltered and protected, and they all have a gazillion drivers, and they live in fancy, you know, military compounds and stuff like that. Raoul's kids kind of wander the streets. They take the bus. You know, they have jobs. They, I mean, they're totally privileged. They have a mazillion bodyguards. You know, everybody who's in a position of some authority has a car, but they grew up much more like hanging out with the people. So when there really are no bananas, you know, Raoul's kids
they're
come
aware.
Home and report,
really no
you
bananas.
Know, it's like, hey, there really are no bananas, you know. And so he has a much more internal focus. On the other hand, he's absolutely vicious with the dissidents. He has a very different methodology of dealing with them. I mean, Fidel basically ignored the dissidents, just paid them no mind. They did not exist.
And knew they had limited resources anyway.
Knew so they had just limited resources, knew that he had a monopoly in media, didn't give a damn. And when somebody finally just crossed him to the point where it was like, okay, now you're on my nerves, you know, there would be a sham trial. They would send that guy up for 30, 40 years, and you never hear from that sucker again, you know. There would be a million international campaigns to get that fool out. Eventually, they would come out looking like some Halloween skeleton. But Cubans would never hear from that person ever again, you know. Raoul does not do that. Raoul harasses the living daylights out of dissidents. He has mobs that are, and when you see the videos, you realize it's the same damn people. This is their job.
I mean, violently?
Violently. They, you know, beat the shit out of dissidents. They harass them. They block them in their homes. Don't let them march.
Is it because he perceives that their movement might be growing in a way that it wasn't when Fidel was in power?
Well, I think it's different. I think one of the things that has happened is that, you know, Raoul has had to make certain moves that, for example, he had to legalize cell phones in 2008, 45 years after the invention of the cell phone. He had to legalize cell phones for Cubans because what was happening was that Cubans were getting them anyway. The black market was moving, and they weren't able to keep track of everybody who had one. And, you know, it was a lot of foreigners who were getting the phones. And I mean, at one point, I had 5 different cell phones in Havana, if you looked at the records. Obviously, I wasn't even in Havana, you know? you know, so who was using those phones? Well, all my neighbors.
Yeah.
All my neighbors had phones. And I'm one of those weird people who counts as Cuban for something and not as Cuban for others. So, but I mean, because of my American passport, I could get the phones. Mm. I mean, perfectly legal, all of it, because they were all in my name. You know, they weren't satellite phones. They were just plain-ass, you know, handies. Mm-hmm. Eventually, it became very clear that, first of all, they could use the revenue. They understood that those phones were going to stay alive, not because Cubans were going to pay for them, but because Cuban-Americans were going to love the idea of being able to talk to their relatives with some regularity, and they would fund the phones, which they do. But those that means that a whole lot more people on the streets have phones. And you can't just, you know, send a cop to beat somebody or to or to intimidate somebody. So now what you do, what you see is a lot of mobs beat the out of people. And then the government always says, well, it's the people. People are enraged.
These are just thugs.
Right. And, you know, which begs the question of law and order. It's like, well, okay, fine. Let's say that it's true, that this is a purely grassroots rage against these dissidents who they view as, you know, traitors. You know, let's say that this is true. Isn't the responsibility of the authorities to keep violence from happening no matter who instigates it? I mean, and the other thing that always happens is that after these horrible beatings, and these terrible confrontations, the people who get hauled away, always against their will, are the dissidents.
Are the dissidents, they spend the night in the joint.
Right.
Whereas the mob goes and has some rum.
And sometimes they don't even spend the night. I mean, sometimes, you know, they're held for, they're just held for hours. They're just harassed, you know, to death. It's a very different, much more wearing, I think, kind of, you know.
And that that affects the... psychologically, the psychology of the dissident.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And it also discourages people who might want to get involved.
Of course.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, and there are a lot more dissident groups now. I don't know that there are a lot more dissidents under Raul than there were before. But there's certainly a lot more vocal organizations. I mean, we're the masters of disorganization. So, I mean, the idea of a popular uprising in Cuba is absurd because we're just completely disorganized human beings.
In with the mild exception of the baseball argument that occurs every every day at 1 o'clock at a park bench in Central Park in Havana.
Central Park.
That one that thing's organized.
That thing is organized. Isn't that crazy?
And for listeners who don't know, there's a park that's across the street from the Hotel Inglaterra. It's the Central Park, right? And yeah, I think it's 1 o'clock. You can go out there, sit around, and
talk wait baseball
for these guys to show up, and they get fired up about these
baseball. They get in your face. You know, they get, but they don't hit each other.
No. It's almost like, you know, again from the point of view of how do you socially engineer and manage mass emotions. You know, it's almost like a place where you can go to vent out frustrations. And it's legal, right? You can talk about
You can
baseball,
say anything you want about
and
you, baseball.
And you can yell about the pitcher or whatever, or scream and yell about how great the Yankees are. What is amazing is how knowledgeable, to the day, Cubans are about baseball. I mean,
because everybody has an illegal satellite. In Havana. I mean, and have you ever been on a rooftop in Havana?
I got to see the rooftops from the roof of the hotel, right? And I have photographs of them. And yeah, the two items that I noticed was the satellite antenna and the chicken coops.
Right. I mean, yeah, there's a whole world up there. But the satellites, and, you know, and Raul did do a big crackdown on the satellites. But, you know, Cubans just got smarter. I mean, they put their antennas in...
chimneys.
In chimneys and in plastic garbage cans where it didn't affect the antenna. They, you know, set them in ways that you couldn't see them that easily. And I mean, it's become like a job to learn how to disguise satellites. But also they've after an initial crackdown, they've kind of walked away from it. I think in part because they simply don't have the resources. To do that. You know, the other thing is that information now travels much quicker. You know, the internet is, they had to make the internet available because they were going to lose tourism if they said to those German tourists, oh no, we don't have internet here. You know, it was like, For some people, that's money.
Mm-hmm.
So they've set it up so that you cannot get private internet. Mm-hmm. It's when you stay in a hotel in Cuba, you don't have Wi-Fi in your room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got to participate. There's a computer downstairs that you can go and
use. Yeah, there's one or two, mm-hmm. or in the case of the Parque Central Hotel, there's actually a business office where you can go and
I did. I went in there to get photocopies done.
Right,
yeah.
Right. So it's like a little Kinko's, and it's got like four or five computers. And so you're in a public place. I mean, it's also a way to keep track of, you know, foreigners who are gonna, do bad things and stuff like that. But they have had to allow people email access. Now, this is a distinction.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have internet access. They have email access. It's like having Outlook, but nothing else. You don't have a browser. Mm-hmm. You don't. You know. You just have.
Mm-hmm.
You just have Outlook.
Mm-hmm.
So Cubans have Outlook,
mm-hmm.
but what this means is that it. You know. You get. You're able to pass information around quite a bit. Some people, you know, who are a little bit higher up in the food chain, do through work. Always, you never have an individual account. Through your work unit, you could have access to the internet. And what a lot of those people do is they sell their passcode.
Yeah, sure.
For a certain amount of time. For example, every time... You know, I go to Havana. There's
black market.
Yeah, there's someone who will sell me their password, but you can only use it during a certain amount of time. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, and it'll be really absurd times. Mm-hmm. Like, you know,
four in the morning.
You can have it between 4 and 5, or between 4 and 6, and then you know, and so that's when you get up and you do all your stuff. But the point is that there's enough of these people out there who are selling their passwords and doing shit, and everybody's got a little memory stick, and people are just sticking those things everywhere and passing information around.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, nobody surfs the net because it's too expensive. You know, it's $9 an hour at the Parque Central to get on the internet, $6 at Sevilla. That's a lot for a Cuban whose average wage is like $20 a month, So you just get on, download, get out of there, read it at home, you know? I mean, nobody ever reads anything online. You see when Cubans get on, and they can't get on at Parque Central, but some of the smaller hotels like the Sevilla or, you know, further away from city center, they'll let a Cuban get on. You see them just very quickly, just download, zip up and out, up and out. Or you see Cuban girls with foreigners, and you can see that they're directing the foreigner on what to download. Mm. They're not on the internet. Mm. It's not. They're not doing anything illegal.
Mm.
And they know that the foreigner is going to help them out.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a lot different now than it used to be. I mean, Fidel could say anything he wanted, and there'd be no way
to verify it, really,
right?
You know?
So it was the truth by default, you know. And now you have this very incongruous situation where Cuban TV continues to report as if, you know, Cuba is the best place in the world. Everything is pretty fine. Everything is a triumph. Mm-hmm. But everybody has access to things very quickly.
Yeah.
You know
that Cuba is the best place in the world sounds like a country that we both know really, really well. That repeats the same thing over and over again on TV. You know.
Yeah.
Let's talk in the last 10 minutes here of the. Today, Paul Ryan, the new vice presidential candidate, announced that he's flip-flopping his position on the embargo. What is your position on the embargo?
Well, I think it should be lifted.
Give me your rationalization about why.
Well, the whole point of the embargo when it was imposed on Cuba in 1961 was to break the revolutionary government, bankrupt them, and then force regime change. And we are now, 51 years later, and it's the same dudes who are in charge. Clearly a failed policy. I don't think you can make an argument about against the failure of that policy.
Mm-hmm.
And what it basically has done is it's given the Cuban government an excuse for absolutely everything that goes wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely everything that goes wrong becomes the fault of the embargo. Mm-hmm. I think that there are many things that go wrong because of the embargo. I don't think that because it is an excuse, there is also no truth in it. There is truth in it.
Sure.
And then it becomes the convenient truth for everything. But, you know, the problem is that the people who suffer the embargo, the effects of the embargo, are, you know, not Raul Castro and his kids, not the folks who are in tourism. You know, it's
they have access to everything.
They have access to everything. It's the people who are, you know, very, you know, los cubanos de a pie, you know, the people who are on, you know, on the streets, you know, the common people. I mean, there are so many medicines that you can't get in Cuba because they're American, you know, medicines. There's so much technology that because of the close relationship that Cuba and the United States had, you know, it's just, you know, it is American and really cannot function without American parts, you know, although Cubans try. And so, you know, the country is, you know, suffers because of this embargo in ways that are really, I think, quite unimaginable to most people.
And inhumane. I mean,
it's totally inhumane. It's just,
when you know that it's happening, when you know that that people on the street are quite literally starving.
I mean, personally, I mean, do I think an embargo is theoretically, yes. Am I willing to consider that there might be a time when an embargo is what makes sense? Of course, I'm willing to consider it. I mean, I start from this place where I think, my God, you should not do that to a people. So, I mean, my position isn't absolutist because I'm open to hearing the argument. But it certainly has absolutely, unquestionably failed. I think it remains a part of American foreign policy because as time has gone by, Florida has become much more important in terms of the Electoral College. And the Cuban-American community in Florida holds on to the embargo, the older...
I mean, is it a form of nostalgia or something?
No, it's not nostalgia. It's not nostalgia. It is so far from nostalgia. It's a bitterness. You know, it's a real...
It sounds worse.
Yeah, it's a real bitterness. It's, you know, it's still... It's about a people, it's about a generation of people who had a very romantic and dependent idea of the United States. They saw themselves as the good guys in this battle. They did all the right things. They aspired to be very American-like. And I'm not just talking about money. I'm talking about everything culturally. You know,
language, art.
No, not language, but... Cuba is very nationalistic about.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you don't have. It's not like the Polish immigrant who says there will be no Polish spoken here.
Absolutely not. In fact, almost exactly
the opposite.
Yeah. Language, literature. No, we think we're the greatest. Our arrogance will not be contained. But you know, who had a close relationship with the United States, certainly a close sentimental relationship with the United States, and who feels that the United States owes them deposing this dictator, you know, especially post Bay of Pigs. It's like, we tried to do it ourselves and you didn't let us, which I always find an outrageous argument, but which I've heard straight up from people. You know, it's like, really? We are responsible for our own U.S.-backed invasion, and so they didn't have the right to call it off at the last minute, and thus they owe us? Because it seems to me like our own U.S.-backed invasion becomes not our own, the moment it's U.S.-backed, I'm just saying, you know? you know, so there's this thing where it's like, this is the last shred of what America owes them, because they didn't go through with Bay of Pigs. So what it really means is that there is this older, very entrenched, but very politically active and very media dominant generation, especially on radio, talk radio, and they saturate the city, who keeps putting this stuff out. Now, support for the embargo actually has been diminishing among Cuban Americans for years. I'm fairly certain if you go to the Miami Herald website and you look, there's a little section for polling, and they always ask the question about the embargo. They, you know, that it's it's absolutely under 60%. And if you flip and you look through the different age groups, it actually is more younger Cuban Americans are against the embargo than for it, especially the younger immigrants, the younger, the newer,
the recent ones,
the more recent immigrants are absolutely against it because they have a relationship with Cuba. They continue to go back. They support relatives. Many of them have a much greater economic impetus for being here than a political one. And it's not that they are economic immigrants per se, but their impetus is economic and political rather than my parents' generation, which was political. And in fact, they had an economic disincentive to come. But so it's a, you know, it's become this red meat that gets thrown politically at Florida to guarantee turnout. I mean, I'm always, my mom is a Republican, and my mom, you know, will tell you she votes Republican because she is a Republican, which I always find a maddening argument to have with her because it's like, well, then you can't get mad at people when they say I support this bad decision of the revolution because I'm a revolutionary. You know, because basically you're saying I've signed on to the program, whatever. And she says, well, no, they're the only ones that are pro-Cuba. They're the ones, they're still the only ones who are against the Castro regime. And I'm like, tell me, please, what they've done. After 8 years of Bush, after 12 years of Reagan-Bush, what happened with Cuba during those times? What in heaven's name happened with Cuba that would engender this kind of loyalty, this kind, nothing, just rhetoric. They say all the right things. They talk about liberty, they talk about blah, 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 blah. And, you know, and the Democrats just don't warmonger. I mean, I'm no great fan of the Democrats, believe me, but, you know, their rhetoric is just a lot less angry, and they're more willing to negotiate and to try diplomatic stuff that, you know, my mother is driven nuts about. I mean, she still holds it against Jimmy Carter that he opened up the intersection.
Well, actually, we've run out of time. Thank you very much for the interesting conversation, and I wish you the best in your career and in your blog. Can't wait
to
see
what it looks like. Hopefully be for tomorrow.
That'd be great. All right. Acho Beja.
You've been listening to Liquid Sound on Morton College Radio. I'm your host, Gintaras. Liquid Sound airs every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock here on Morton College Radio, and all of the shows are currently archived at Liquid Inc., my website, gint-aras.com, gint-aras.com. As always, thanks so much for listening, and have a good night.